Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have a figure well known to First Things reader, Michael Hanby, who is professor of religion and philosophy of science at the John Paul II Institute. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, you know, I'm going to jump right into something you wrote that many people listening
I'm
now
going to have to own up
read.
To
this. This is actually the first paragraph of an article that appeared under the title "A More Perfect Absolutism," about a year and a half ago. Here's the beginning. It is part of the absurdity of American life that we decide questions of truth under the guise of settling contests of rights, which means that we decide questions of truth without thinking deeply or even very, very honestly about them. Thus, while it is obvious to many that we are living through a profound cultural revolution, it is less than clear just what sort of revolution it is. Although with Obergefell and the Obama administration's recent decree abolishing human nature in response to North Carolina's bathroom law, it takes a real effort not to see. The sexual revolution is not simply an overturning of sexual morality or family law, but a revolution in our fundamental view of human nature that promises to reshape who we are as human beings. What previous generations took for granted, for example, that man, woman, mother, and father name natural realities as well as social roles, that children issue naturally from their union, that the marriage of man and woman is the foundation of human society. All this is now increasingly regarded as obsolete and even hopelessly bigoted. A question, Michael, how in the world did we get to this point?
What this article essentially was about, and this was an attempt to provide a lead-in for this, I mean, obviously we're undergoing a profound cultural change and a very rapid cultural change, both inside and outside the church. And the article, in one sense, was an attempt to name that change and to get at the heart of it and to anticipate where it may lead us and to give some kind of a sense of the underlying causes, though I don't pretend that this is a monocausal explanation or that the upheaval that we're going can simply be understood as the outworking of a kind of development in philosophy. But the basic idea, which is controversial among some of my more conservative friends, is that the revolution in political philosophy at the beginning of the modern period is itself the expression of a deeper revolution in our underlying understanding of nature. And that is really, I think, true to the order of things. Political philosophy is not first philosophy. It always presupposes some understanding of reality, some understanding of who the human being is, and some broader understanding of God being in nature. And those all underwent dramatic transformations, revolutionary transformations, from the 16th through the 18th centuries.
I was going to ask when you said the modern period. Yeah, you're thinking of coming out of into early modernity.
Yeah, early modernity, and it transformed our basic notions of reason, being, freedom, nature, and truth. And what I want to suggest, although I know that many find this implausible, is that in some ways the sexual revolution is the apex or the outworking of those basic assumptions. The shorthand way that I would characterize that transformation in the understanding of both nature and knowledge is technological. That is to say, it's the conversion of nature into a kind of machine or system transparent to mechanical forms of analysis. And that, I mean, perhaps the best way to unpack this is to begin with the title, which was not my invention, actually, but it aptly summarizes, I think, what the article is trying to say. What kind of absolutism does the article refer to? And what I'm trying to argue is that it refers to the absolutism of a technological order, of an order of and by technological order I mean not simply the proliferation of devices and mechanical processes upon which we have all become dependent and which we can't imagine our lives without and which, in all honesty, we wouldn't want to imagine our lives without. But in its most primary sense, the absolutism of a way of looking at, understanding, and knowing the world, namely as an artifact that we know by unmaking and remaking, that is to say, by means of manipulation. And that this understanding has really come to affect our self-understanding. I mean, and to understand the sexual revolution principally as the outworking, not simply, as that opening quote mentions, a revolution in moral norms or in family law or any of the rest of it, but a revolution in our basic understanding of nature and of ourselves and of how and as what and of what will count as authoritative knowledge of those things.
I think that certainly fits in the sense of how people look at their bodies so often these days. Their bodies become something to work upon, something to alter technologically, and that somehow a natural relationship to their body has been substituted for by a
bifurcated or a dualistic understanding.
Okay.
You know, the body as meaningless raw material,
right?
That is the receptacle for either the societal imposition of meaning, right, identities that are given to me prior to my choosing them, mm-hmm. or receptacles for my own either affective or technological will.
Right, right, right. And the sexual revolution really is the big step in which we involve our bodies in this technological approach to nature. That was, I mean, people weren't doing things to their bodies 100 years ago like they are today. I mean everything from tattooing to gender reassignment surgery to altering your natural. I mean, there was this other side of the 60s that said, my body is a temple, right? That I need to respect my body for what it is, but that's lost, right? That's gone. The body is really a machine that either suits my purposes, either expressive purposes or sexual purposes, or it doesn't, and then I've got to change it.
Yeah, the way I've written about it in this article and elsewhere is that the sexual revolution is the point at which the technological revolution is brought to bear upon ourselves and upon our self-understanding. And of course, that's not all it is. That doesn't exclude the other explanations or the other descriptions of the sexual revolution as a revolution in morality, etc. And you know, the phenomena you mention are obviously one aspect of that, the revolution in biotechnology, assisted reproductive technologies, and all the rest of it would be another manifestation and an interrelated manifestation of that. But to take a couple of steps back and to look at this from a distance, I think one of the ways, and maybe this more clearly states what I was trying to say earlier, in the time since I began working on these things, Carlo Lancelotti has translated into English the works of Augusto Del Noce, who I had not encountered before, and I have found that many of the things that I was already thinking have received a kind of confirmation or clarification from his thought. And one of the ways to describe the revolution in early modernity that continues, it seems to me, and is presents a problem, it seems to me, or a great unknown, both for the future of Western society, but also for the church, is what he calls the de-Hellenization or the de-Platonization of Christianity in the West, the loss of a sense of or conviction in a transcendent order of being, the priority of eternal things over temporal things. And therefore of a nature that is known into being through the divine ideas and that is immutable. Mm-hmm. And the dissolution, if you will, of that order of being into time or into history, mm-hmm. and therefore into contingent and manipulable historical configurations. that revolution in metaphysics and natural philosophy, the loss of the Platonic sense, and by the Platonic sense, by the way, I mean also to include the, you know, the Aristotelian understanding. I mean, there are different ways, it seems to me, of and there have been many and many contested ways within the history of Western philosophy and Western Christianity or Christianity of articulating the priority of the eternal over the historical, the order of being over the order of development. But when that is eclipsed, when or when the order of time and the order of being are conflated, when being is reduced to history, it transforms the meaning of reason and truth as well. Nature now is no longer a principle. It's simply whatever happens or can be made to happen, which we know by reconstructing the series of cause and effects or reproducing them. And so when being is reduced to history, when nature is reduced to an artifact, knowledge itself becomes a kind of engineering, mm-hmm. and truth becomes functional, pragmatic. What Del Noce sees, it seems, and this is right, and there are all sorts of evidence of, you know, there's abundant evidence of this, is that the primacy, if you will, of power, functional power on the ontological level, leads to the primacy of the political at the social level. Mm-hmm. Practical reason triumphs entirely over contemplative or speculative reason in the classical sense, which now make really no sense even. Mm-hmm. And the world runs largely according, in a largely sophistic fashion. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk, you're getting down to phenomenological understandings here. I mean, how does the world, how do I approach the world, my fundamental assumptions about them, about the world? What are my horizon of expectations what are my premises? What are the terms, the frameworks of my thought? That's where we have to get back to. The sexual revolution is not going to be reversed by a court decision working in another direction. It's not going to be reversed by a change of administrations, a political administration. That's to play the game that has been set up, right, by the removal of speculative reason, by the conversion of nature and ourselves into things that we can then manipulate to our uses. Are you frustrated that the people who are dismayed by the sexual revolution, by the politicization of everything in the progressive mindset, are you frustrated that many of the people who want to reform or correct those errors really are operating within the terms, we'll just say liberalism? They're operating within the terms of practical reason alone. And that if we don't re-Hellenize our outlooks, if we don't start incorporating the transcendent levels of being into this world of becoming, we're going to lose every time. Eventually, we're going to lose.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think we're going to lose anyway. Okay. I mean, not eschatologically speaking,
yeah.
But you know, one of the great illusions that we've comforted ourselves with for a long time is that it's possible, and we've attempted to construct a social order in which it is possible to be Christian without suffering. Mm-hmm. And there's a great deal of suffering ahead, both imposed from without, but as a consequence of our own self-inflicted harms through. The sins of the church. Yes, I do think that the habituated triumph of practical over speculative reason, and the primacy of political reason over every other form of reason among modern people, and particularly, I think, among Americans. I think there are interesting historical reasons why this is the case for us. In a sense, blinds us to or prevents us from seeing what is at stake in a great many of our public debates. I mean, and in a sense, that's what the opening remark or the opening lines of that article were attempting to get at. It's remarkable the superficiality with which the whole argument over same-sex marriage was conducted on both sides, as if there were nothing at stake or implied about the very nature of men and women and children in this decision. And so what appears to be simply a contest over civil rights is actually a philosophical debate that doesn't recognize itself about the very nature of things. Mm-hmm. Part of my complaint against liberal public reason is that it prevents us and excludes that kind of argument from having any public weight whatsoever. So one of the things that I think is really telling is what counts as a reasonable argument in the eyes of the courts, for instance, and the fact that and the legal nomenclature escapes me, but the fact that traditional arguments or arguments for what has now come to be known as traditional marriage, you know, marriage as the union of man and woman, are themselves don't even pass a minimal rational threshold, speaks volumes about what counts as reason mm-hmm. in liberal society. Mm-hmm. And it's only one form or other of a kind of pragmatic technical reason. Since when did the very nature of or the reality of men and women become matters of faith? What ironically is excluded, it seems to me, from the way that our conventional social contests are framed, as a contest between a kind of rigorously empirical and scientific understanding on the one hand, and the irrational claims the irrational idiosyncratic claims of various faith communities on the other hand. What is actually excluded from the public square is not so much faith, which continues to play the role of the useful idiot in those arguments, and the foil to those who base their positions on the authority of science. I mean, notice the way now that the appeal to science is deployed as a political weapon. What is excluded from all of that actually is philosophical reason, in anything like a traditional sense.
What would a philosophical reasoning person say in a same-sex marriage debate? What would the intervention by that person sound like?
Well, I mean, part of the difficulty, of course, I mean, something that has to be said from the outset is that philosophy now understood in a reduced sense as one among many contemporary academic disciplines mm-hmm. is in complete disarray. Right, and is not excluded from this transformation that we're talking about. In fact, American pragmatism, which is America's great gift to philosophy, is in a certain sense philosophical justification for the very end of for philosophical suicide. I mean, mm-hmm. if you read someone like Richard Rorty, for instance, it seems to me that he's quite explicit about this. This is why I love Rorty's thought in a kind of perverse way. It makes all this very clear, and John Dewey was the same way. But from a traditional point of view, that is to say, from the point of view of someone thinking in the Platonic or Aristotelian tradition, the problem with something like same-sex marriage is that it is an act of violence against what human beings are as men and women. Mm-hmm. But it's interestingly, in a when reason is reduced to a kind of functional pragmatic reason, the question what things are is precisely the kind of question that's no longer intelligible to us and that we can no longer think about, even though it's built into arguably in a way that can't be eradicated, built into the structure of thought. And so we end up answering the question of what things are. What is a human? Who is the human person? What is a man? What is a woman? By other means, in functionalist terms. Mm-hmm. That's consequent upon the loss of a notion of nature and form.
Everyone should be happy. It's that simple. Well, everyone should be happy, which means everyone should be able to do whatever they want, as long as it just doesn't interfere with anyone else. We don't need to go into all those deep philosophical ideas about what a human being is, right? I mean, hasn't liberal political philosophy begun? You know, the mill, the liberty idea. Doesn't that solve all the problems? I mean, let people get married if they want. Whoever wants to get married, what's the big deal?
The problem is, of course, which I touch on in this article that you referred to, is that you can't redefine something as fundamental as marriage in isolation. Marriage and what it presupposed about the nature of men and women has been fundamental to human experience. It has been fundamental to the organization of human society. It's been fundamental to how we've understood family. So, in effect, you can't bracket this question out simply as a question of the rights of a few without fundamentally altering and necessarily altering our understanding of everything else. And in fact, this is what we're seeing, right? I mean, the implicit in the notion of same-sex marriage is the idea that the relationship between parents and children, mothers and fathers and children being born to a mother and father, is merely a matter of convention and therefore arbitrary and therefore interchangeable with any other configuration where love is present. That necessarily involves a rethinking of the nature of kinship. And in fact, I would argue that one of the consequences of the Obergefell decision is to obliterate natural relations or kinship relations in the eyes of the law and to replace them simply with legal relations, which will ultimately be adjudicated by the courts. Mm-hmm. It is to place artificial conception on a par with or make it perhaps even superior to natural conception, which has knock-on implications for how we understand the nature of women, how we understand the relationships between parents and children. It has required, and we have seen, an assault upon language, right? The elementary experience of recognizing myself as male or female and others as male or female and having a language that corresponds to that has to be remade. There's no dimension of our social structure or our received human inheritance, which remains untouched by this. And yet none of that was brought to bear on the very narrow question of whether this is a right or not. That's part of what I mean by saying that we adjudicate questions of truth under the guise of settling contests of rights, and therefore we don't think about them. And with respect to – I had forgotten the whole of your question, or maybe it was an earlier question. But when you asked about doesn't liberalism dispense with the need for thinking philosophically? I mean, first of all, I don't know why we would want to go through life thoughtlessly. And in fact, there is
– a lot of people do.
There is a kind of enforced thoughtlessness built into this. I mean, the question of what it is we are no longer allowed to think about or no longer allowed or are no longer able or will no longer be able to think about once these transformations have set in, the kinds of questions we can no longer ask ourselves, like, for instance, who is my mother? The child of two fathers, so to speak. That would be a naturally occurring question mm-hmm. heretofore. Now there's something wrong. It seems to me that there would be something wrong with you for asking it. Mm-hmm. So the first point is that I don't know why we would think it good to go through life thoughtlessly. But the second thing is that insofar as truth impresses itself upon us, and thinking about truth is an ineradicable dimension of human thought, it's not the case that we don't think philosophically anymore. It's that we do it very poorly, and we do it without being aware of the gravity of our decisions, and we do it carelessly. The question of what things are, though we have forgotten how to ask it and we have forgotten how to think about it, is not a question that can ultimately go unasked. It will be answered in practice, and we are answering it in practice. Obergefell answers it in practice, it seems to me.
You know, the idea that the progressive or liberal agenda today is about do your own thing is belied by those episodes in which a dissenter from the progressive premises is targeted. He's not left alone, as we see what happened to just a few weeks ago to Masterpiece Cake Shop. You saw that after the decision came down, upholding his right to refuse to design a same-sex wedding celebration birthday cake, right afterwards, someone went to his shop, who is an openly aggressive culture warrior for the LGBT agenda, went and asked him to design a cake that was, let's see, was it blue on the inside and pink on the outside, because it was going to celebrate a transition of a child from boy to girl. And he said, I can't do this, of course. And it went to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and they charged him again. They're after him again. He was clearly targeted for this. We're going to get him. We're going to take him down. And that's where we find that the individualism that you pointed out is really a false individualism. The individualism that says, well, marriage is just about two people. No, it's not just about two people. It's about kinship. It's about extended family. It's about the children that are going to come along. It's about the larger society
as well.
It's
about the nature of things.
This is the nature of things. And it seems that the going after Jack Phillips is in a way an acknowledgement of that broader agenda beyond just the individualism is of whatever floats your boat, mm-hmm. to recognize that we want to change the nature of things. We don't want to just give people different rights or different freedoms. We really have to change a much, much broader reality out there.
I think that's true. And part of what's – the intolerance of progressive tolerance is now almost a caricature of itself. It's achieved the status of a joke. It's, in a certain sense, that's not that interesting because right. it's so pervasive. But what is interesting to me, and I wrote about this, and this has actually helped seed the way that my thought has sort of moved on or developed since this 2016 piece. Part of what's interesting to me about what's being done to Jack Phillips, for instance, earlier Memory's Pizza? I've forgotten the name of the pizza place
in
Indiana.
But
part of what's interesting, it seems to me, about this is that, I mean, Jack Phillips's life can be ruined without the exercise of state power, it seems to me, at all. Right? A steady campaign exercised through a system of social media intimidation can require him to spend his life and what fortune he has defending himself long before it ever comes to court. And it seems to me that there's not a legislative remedy to that. And it seems to me one of the aspects of the article that I tried to dimension, I do think that if you want to call it the sexual revolution, is the face of a certain kind of absolutism. It's the absolutism of technological order, as I said earlier. But in a sense, it's what I call a post-political absolutism. That is to say, it's the absolutism of a system. And one of the things that's really remarkable about the way these social intimidation campaigns work is that somebody, you know, introduces an input, if you will, into the system. It goes viral. It's taken up and it bounces around. And the very viral nature of it itself becomes a story and therefore feeds further commentary and reaction. And suddenly you have something that behaves systematically for which no one is actually responsible.
Right, right, right.
And yet
– there's no legal remedy.
There's no legal or political remedy, it seems to me.
Or political remedy.
And so what it seems to me that we're facing a kind of systemic absolutism in a couple of different ways, actually. And I try and touch on this in this particular article as well, and some things that I've done since then or in a book that I'm working on or trying to elaborate this further. The way in which technological order is self-perpetuating and constitutes for us a kind of regime of necessity. I mean, we can make decisions about some aspects of this, but we're not free from the necessity of making those decisions. And if the social media apparatus decides to turn its gaze upon someone like Jack Phillips, there's not a great deal that he can do about it. He's going to be required to respond. And it's not clear to me that there's a real remedy, either legislatively or judicially, to this kind of problem.
That's a pessimistic note. I hate to end on that one, but this is something that we all need to realize and face. So I'd like to have you back 6 months from now, Michael, and see if things change.
I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm happy. Although the combination of change and stasis is itself remarkable. So in one sense, I suspect they will have changed, and in another not. But I'm always happy to talk about these things.
All right.
So I would enjoy that.
Thank you.